Welcome back. You're listening to the Healthy Aging Show, and we are continuing with Dr. De La Pena. And we were talking about clinical studies, and this is obviously a subject that is far greater than we had thought when we first started this discussion. I'm going to let you continue where we left off.
Okay, where we left off was, now, if the FDA looks at the data and says, oh, you know what, it's safe, we can go ahead with a phase two. Phase one can last between 3 to 5 years or even more.
Oh,
okay.
My goodness, that's a long time.
That's a long time.
That's why drugs are expensive, because this is a process.
Right. And when you go into phase two, now we're talking about real clinical stuff, because now that drug is going to be tested on what it was really indicated for. For example, if the drug pretty much shows some promise for Alzheimer's, what they're going to do in a phase two study is that they're going to have probably about 100 to 150 patients all across the country who have Alzheimer's, and to test that drug on Alzheimer's. Now, it's going to be a double-blind study. Whenever you come across double-blind study, that means to say that the patient who's taking the medication does not know what kind of medication it is, and the doctor or the treating physician who's giving it doesn't know it either. So it's blinded on both sides. Why is that important? Because if we doctors knew what we were giving, there's no use for a study. We're going to be biased in our evaluations.
We are human.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we're objective.
And if the patient knew what the drug is, whether it's placebo or not, there's no use for a trial either. Because why would I be in a trial? I know already what I'm taking. This way we could measure scientifically which one actually does have an effect more. Is it the placebo or is it the drug? Now, in a phase two study, it's a much larger scale. It's 100 to 150, but there's a lot of safety measures that are actually being done. There's a lot of safety procedures that are being done. So when we talk about phase two, we talk about 50% we're testing the drug's efficacy, but 50% we're also still testing for the safety of the drug. Now, that could last between 3 to 7 years for phase two. It really depends. Now, again, the FDA looks at the data and says, oh, you know what? It actually does help. It goes into phase three now. Phase three is a much, much bigger trial. It could probably have 300 to 500 patients all across the country. Now, what is the focus of a phase three study? A phase three study is the last phase before a drug is approved for commercial use. Now, in a phase three study, it's a much, much larger scale, but then the focus is more on efficacy now. It's 75% efficacy and 25% of safety. It's still a double-blind study in most of the trials. Why is that? Because we still have to make sure that we're able to scientifically determine whether the drug really has this effect, this beneficial effect, or no effect at all.
But I would think from the doctor's standpoint, would you want to be the person deciding who's getting the placebo and who's not?
Well,
be a very uncomfortable
in a double-blind study, you're not. Somebody else is. And that's got to, if you knew it, it would radiate through the way you approach and deal with each of the participants in the study.
Right.
As you said, we're human.
Right.
And it would skew the entire result because of the personal effect,
the
psychological.
Right. Now, which segues me to the topic that you just brought up about the family support, or they're being seen on a regular basis, and is this really going to help? This is the beauty of clinical trials. If you're seen by your doctors once every 6 months or once a year, in clinical trials, you're going to be seen almost every month with the family, because usually when we do Alzheimer's trials, there will always be a caregiver. Half of the time we spend with the patient to evaluate the patient, guess what? Half of the time we spend with a caregiver. The reason is because we need to get that feedback from the caregiver. And these are all structured interviews, basically. We need to get that feedback from the caregiver, because it's the caregiver who is actually with the patient 24/7 or most of the time, compared to us, who only sees the patient for about an hour or so.
No one knows them better than the caregiver.
Right,
that's
very
correct.
Often the patient will give you a very positive. If for some reason with our doctors, we tend to...
Oh, you'll get 180 degrees difference between the caregiver and the patient.
Right. Now, going back to your question, Dawn, about, okay, maybe it's their participation that's actually helping them out. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because if they're there every now and then and they're being tested and they're being evaluated, like what I told you, even for severe demented patients, just that regular follow-up and exposure and the questioning and all of the evaluations and the tests sometimes would make them improve by 38%.
But again, that's the psychological effect.
Right.
If not the placebo effect, it's certainly
the support.
That is elevating their hope.
Right. Now, wouldn't you want to be in a clinical trial that you think might benefit you, not just because of the drug itself, but by the support that you
get? Well, as I'm sitting here listening to what you say, as opposed to sitting home ruminating about my disease?
Exactly.
Yes.
You're doing something about it. Going back again to what Dawn said about maybe it's a contribution to society. It really is. You would be so surprised with most families that come in. They would say, okay, well, if it's not going to help my mom, at least it's going to help somebody else. But what they're in fact really saying is that if it's not going to help mom, it's going to help us.
And whether it's a contribution to society, it is, it's an activity. I would imagine that compared to non-participants, that there is a positive effect in their survivability. And I was
right.
going to ask you if there's a study on the effect of participating in a clinical study on the prognosis or on their ability to live longer in a better quality of life.
Well, there hasn't been really a direct study on that directly, pretty much measuring that. But there had been studies on people who have been made busy with routines in their lives.
Right.
There's this one study that pretty much focuses on people who are a little bit more resistant to the disease whenever they have a purpose in life. That's very important to note because, you know, they have noticed that people who really don't have that much purpose in living are the ones who are very much susceptible to it. It's pretty amazing.
It's like waking up in the morning and you go through the list of what you have to do and
right.
what you have to look forward to
right.
and waking up in the morning and not having a list and not having something to look forward to.
Right.
That's got to be tough. Very tough.
And that's the reason why most of our caregivers who have loved ones who have the disease would come up to us and say, you know what? My mom knows that, you know, she's going to be in your office today because she's going to be interviewed again. It adds structure. And believe it or not, structure helps people.
And that resonates out with the caregiver as well. That helps the caregiver's role in that relationship. It's encouraging for them too.
Correct. Because now the caregiver becomes more cognizant of the fact that I need to come up with answers to these questions. And therefore, I have to pretty much eyeball my mom every now and then to be able to come up with a more accurate answer.
Now, let's take this to what the current news has been all about.
Okay.
We've been hearing so much about breakthroughs in diagnostic tests that are able to predetermine someone's propensity for having or getting Alzheimer's. There's the spinal tap that has been mm-hmm. talked about. There is the tests involving the PET scan. Then there is a group that was formed about 10 years ago that has been credited with kind of bringing together so much of the research and sharing of data that has enabled some of this to come up through the system faster than perhaps it might have previously. And I think the most recent was the spinal tap.
That's big.
Well, it's big.
It's big.
But I'm just wondering, it was a group of 300 people that were tested, as I understand.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was over a 5-year period. And the big part of it was that the claim of 100% predictability was used. But there were certain caveats in that 100%, I believe.
Well, the number one reason that you said it's a breakthrough. Well, it's not really much of a breakthrough with just finding the treatment, but also diagnosing the disease. They found out right now that most of the experts have pretty much convened on the idea that Alzheimer's, when it shows the symptoms, pretty much probably already in the early stages or the middle stages of but the disease could have been in them for the last 10 years. And the beauty of actually being able to diagnose it much, much earlier is that we can do something about it. Not that there's any treatment out there yet. There's no cure out there yet. Let me be very clear about this, because there's always this misconception that people who come to the office or who ask me, oh, well, I'm taking this medication, this commercially available medication, and it's supposed to make me better. None of the commercially available medications for Alzheimer's or memory loss right now are cures.
And we want cure, yes.
They are all what we would call symptomatic treatments of the disease, which means to say they control probably the symptoms of the disease. But do they attack the disease itself or halt it? No. So none of these medications right now are what we would call disease modifying. None of those are disease modifying. Why is it becoming more and more evident to us right now that we're pretty much probably near the verge of getting into a breakthrough? Yeah, because there are a number of clinical studies that we're doing right now. We're really attacking the cause of the disease, which means to say that there's this possibility or this promise of halting the disease or reversing it.
Are there any studies right now in particular that you're really focusing on?
We're doing the immunotherapy studies, the ones that they have actually discussed in the Alzheimer's Association International Conference for Alzheimer's Disease, or the AICAD, in 2010 in Honolulu.
Right.
There were a number of big studies that were actually being monitored. These studies are the studies wherein we're testing a certain medication that would hopefully halt the disease or reverse it in its early stages. Why is this? How come this is so different from all the medications that are out there right now? Because, like what I said, we are testing disease-modifying agents, or what they perceive to be disease-modifying agents. When we talk about disease-modifying agents, these are agents that will hopefully change the course of the disease. And immunotherapy studies, they're very exciting studies. Why? Okay, let's go back now to the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. The hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, when you open up somebody's brain who's actually diseased with Alzheimer's, you'll find what we would call beta amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. Now, this beta amyloid plaques pretty much are deposits, you know, outside of the brain itself. And what it does is it causes the decay of the brain, and therefore the interconnections, the nerve connections are also destroyed. And that's the reason why the brain could not communicate inside itself.
It's like a short circuit.
Correct. Or even worse than that, no circuit.
No circuit at all.
There's no bridge.
There's no bridge.
Okay.
So, and the other thing is the neurofibrillary tangles, with the discovery of the tau protein, which actually causes these neurofibrillary tangles. Now, these tangles, like what I say in most of my lectures, are pretty much the same as the tangles that you see at the bottom of your bathtub if you don't clean it for a number of months. So, what does it do? It actually causes clogging of the pipes, and you've got all these dirt and all these germs and stuff. That's what pretty much happens. So it kills, you know, the network of the brain too. Now, the tau protein is what they're actually very much interested when they're doing a spinal tap, because there is no procedure right now that would pretty much test the amount of tau protein that leads into neurofibrillary tangles, nor is there any test right now that would measure the beta amyloid burden in the brain.
Okay. We're just talking about the development of the spinal tap and the discovery of the tau
protein.
And that's one of the markers that is now believed to be present in diagnosed Alzheimer's patients.
So you've got a partnership between the plaque and the tau.
Oh, yeah.
Working together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's the amyloid and the tau.
The beta amyloid plaque and the neurofibrillary tangles. So that's
to be specific.
Okay. Now, one of the things that came out of the Hawaiian conference this year was new guidelines for diagnosing Alzheimer's disease. And in part, I guess this is because the ability to diagnose is so much greater than it was several years ago. And where it used to be only upon autopsy that a definitive diagnosis of the disease could be made, now there's a very strong feeling that with the things that we've talked about, the spinal tap and some of the other tests, that end because it is believed to basically be in a gestational period, 10 years prior to or thereabouts, when it really appears that there will be new designations. And the upside to that is that you'll be able to find people sooner. Perhaps the downside to that is that they're going to know sooner, or that they're going to know, period. And there are certain social and economic and political implications that play into that.
How accurate is the test? And that was part of the concern, was the accuracy.
Well, there are actually two tests tests that we're talking about. The number one thing is that there's really no MRI scans right now could not pretty much visualize or determine the amount of beta amyloid or neurofibrillary tangles in the brain. And right now they're developing a PET scan that would pretty much zero in on the beta amyloid, which is really great because now we'll be able to see beta amyloid and how much it's going to be, if it's actually getting larger, if it's getting smaller. And this will be our gauge also in knowing whether our treatments are getting better or not. The other thing is the spinal tap. The spinal tap pretty much gives you the hallmark signs of Alzheimer's, which is the tau protein or the neurofibrillary tangles and the beta amyloid plaques. So these are the two promising procedures that could actually pretty much probably tell us beforehand whether a patient is developing the disease. The studies also show that even for normal healthy individuals who have some levels of these components, we're later found out to have developed the disease. So yeah, it's really a big thing. Why? Because like what you said, Dennis, you know, it's going to change really a lot of implications, both negative and positive.
It will.
Now, how early do you want to know that you're actually going to get the disease? Especially now that there's really no treatment or cure really help. Will it help you to know that in the next couple of years, your memory is going to be wiped out or something like that? But on the other hand, the earlier you know about it, the more you could do something about it too. And that's the reason why they come hand in hand. You know, the progression of finding the diagnosing the disease early and the progression of science in finding the cure for it.
Well, there's certain things that, you know, lifestyle changes that they may not retard, but they may not advance the disease. And if someone is practicing dangerous lifestyle activities, then with the knowledge that they may have a positive effect by changing from them, that gives you something to do, as well as being identified as a potential candidate or potential diagnosed subject, that you would be part of an information database that would be where information about progress and opportunities for clinical studies and anything that might be helpful in retarding or changing the progression of the disease might be available to you.
The immunotherapy studies right now that we're doing are very exciting studies. Why? Because it's a step closer into not only zeroing in on the causes of the disease, but being able to actually provide explanations on how come a certain disease can be halted at a certain period in time. Let me tell you this before, you know, I think this is a very important thing that most people should know. The immunotherapy studies that we're doing right now are antibody studies. Oh, you're giving me a big smile.
Yeah, well, it was interesting as part of the research.
It is. It is.
Gets to
okay.
The destination it needs to go to.
But most people don't understand what the implication is. Why is it so important? Because now that they have discovered that beta amyloid is actually a component in Alzheimer's brains, they want to attack that. When they did previous studies on this, when we all were little, we were given immunizations, right? Okay. Now, the immunizations that we were involved in, that were given to us, are what we would call active immunizations. Active immunization is when the doctor would actually inject you with a live attenuated virus. Attenuated meaning to say it's not going to cause a disease, but it still has the protein.
We're going to have to take a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to continue to talk about this Alzheimer's research and developments in the disease. We'll be right back.